Okay, we will go back to 2 Samuel tonight, and we'll go through the second chapter. As I said this morning already, I just want to expand a little bit on what I said this morning about some of the difficulties that we will probably face in the book of 2 Samuel. We're looking at the more mature life of David and many decisions that he made. Sometimes he did wrong. Many times he did right. And sometimes as we go through the stories of the Old Testament, God is not specific in the Bible. This man sinned. It just simply tells what happens. And we have to read the stories and draw some conclusions on our own as to the rightness or the wrongness of the situation that we are reading about. We get the same thing through all of church history as well. You can go back to any person in church history that you want to study, and you can read the story of their life. Many, many times we will find in history that there have been amazing Christians who have really devoted their lives to God. But there's not a single one that you can't read, and you can find one thing or two things in their lives or more where they positively disagreed with what the Bible says we should do. And it wasn't intentional on their part. It wasn't from a hard heart where they rebelled against God. But it was just simply we're all born with lacks of understanding. I mean, we don't see things perfectly. And what's the most common thing that you will see is that people are very, very much a product of their time. And so, for example, a man like John Wesley, that right now, through all of the history of the church, he probably stands up there among the top 10 people that have ever lived in history that people look back to and with good feelings they follow what he taught and they love what he was and the work that he did, the revival that came through his work. We look back and we are extremely grateful for John Wesley. But he was completely absolutely unscriptural to the nth degree in his association with the Church of England. Almost everybody in church history understood separation better than John Wesley understood it. But John Wesley, what did he have? What he grew up in the Church of England. How would it have been that he would have come to the understanding all by himself with nobody around him in that day teaching separation from the Church of England because it wasn't the Church of God? It was a point that he didn't ever understand. And so he encouraged the Methodist Church all through his life to stay as members of the Church of England, which they should not have done because the Church of England was not the Church of God. Though throughout all of its history, it had many amazing preachers, and many, many, many were the multitudes of Christians that were a part of that church. It was a mixed multitude. It was a part Christian and it was part not Christian. And so that would be a failure. We look back and say John Wesley didn't understand that doctrine. And after John Wesley died, there became a major fight in the Methodist Church and they left. They left the church because some other people in the church understood they shouldn't be a part of the Church of England. But you know, the funny thing of it is, I would a whole lot rather be under the leadership of John Wesley and in the Church of England than under the leadership of any of the people who succeeded him and out of the Church of England. Which would you guys pick? And you guys can sit here if you want to. I know you probably all do it every Sunday and judge me. And you can tell me something that is wrong in my life. And We have to be careful when we are looking at history, as well as when we are interacting with our friends, that we understand proper times to judge, as well as proper reasons to judge, as well as that we understand truth. Because the first place, most people who end up judging another person end up wrong anyway, because most often in Christian circles, the people who are the least spiritual and the least qualified to judge do the most judging. And the more spiritual and the more qualified to judge have walked more with God, and they understand more of mercy, and they understand more of they themselves become servants rather than judges. And what's more, supposing that we are right sometime, and supposing that I happen to know that such is what the Bible teaches, and so that I know doesn't do what the Bible teaches. The next question is, if I get judgmental on that person and begin to push them to do what I think is right to do, will I help that person or will I hurt that person? Many times we hurt people because you can't take somebody who was raised all of their lives in a certain doctrine and just take them to the scriptures and point them to seven verses and change their mind. Minds don't change that easy. There's whole foundations under that doctrinal system they believe. And those foundations are wrong. And you have to undo those foundations and rebuild those foundations before you can correct the doctrine that they base on them. And the list goes on and on. So we always want to be careful when we are judging history and when we're judging each other that we are mild in our judgment, that we are loving in our judgment, and that we should always leave our minds open a little bit to the fact that maybe I don't quite see this right either. And I'll tell you the honest truth, as we go through 2 Samuel, I am not going to judge David. I am not going to tell you every chapter we read David did right or David did wrong here, because I don't know half of the stories that I read here. I don't even know. I can point to certain things and show, like this chapter that we're in right now, I can tell you some things that are wrong in this chapter, but I can't tell you everything. I can't discern right now, looking at what happened in chapter 2, if David was on the right side or the wrong side of everything that happened. But one thing that we have, we just sang it, the Lord's our rock. And since Jesus doesn't change, ever, He is our rock and our shelter. And it is a place that we can go to for absolutes. We don't have to get afraid when men around us are trembling, because Jesus is always there and constant. The Bible doesn't ever change. It never gets updated except by false people who are changing it, and we reject those Bibles. It's always the same. It says the same thing now that it said 2,000 years ago when it was written. And it is the book that we judge everything by, but we must use this Bible to judge everything in meekness, because if we don't, we will soon become the person who needs to be judged. So let's read chapter 2. It says, "And it came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said unto him, Go up. And David said, Whither shall I go up? And he said, Unto Hebron. So David went up thither, and his two wives also, Ahinoam the Ahinoam the Jezreelitess, and Abigail, Nabal's wife, the Carmelite. And his men that were with him did David bring up, every man with his household, and they dwelt in the cities of Hebron. And the men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah. And they told David, saying, that the men of Jabesh-Gilead were they that buried Saul. And David sent messengers unto the men of Jabesh-Gilead, and said unto them, blessed be ye of the Lord, that ye have showed this kindness unto your Lord, even unto Saul, and have buried him. And now the Lord show kindness and truth unto you, and I also will requite you this kindness, because ye have done this thing. Therefore now let your hands be strengthened, and be ye valiant, for your master Saul is dead, and also the house of Judah have anointed me king over them. But Abner the son of Ner, captain of Saul's host, took Ish-bosheth the son of Saul, and brought him over to Mahanaim, and made him king over Gilead, and over the Asherites, and over Jezreel, and over Ephraim, and over Benjamin, and over all Israel. Ish-bosheth, Saul's son, was 40 years old when he began to reign over Israel, and reigned 2 years. But the house of Judah followed David. And the time that David was king in Hebron over the house of Judah was 7 years and 6 months. And Abner, the son of Ner, and the servants of Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, went out from Mahanaim to Gibeon. And Joab, the son of Zeruiah, and the servants of David went out and met together by the pool of Gibeon. And they sat down, the one on one side of the pool, and the other on the other side of the pool. And Abner said to Joab, let the young men now arise and play before us. And Joab said, let them arise. Then there arose and went over by number 12 of Benjamin, which pertained to Ish-bosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And they caught every one his fellow by the head and thrust his sword in his fellow's side. So they fell down together. Wherefore the place was called Helkith Hazerim, which is in Gibeon. And there was a very sore battle that day, and Abner was beaten, and the men of Israel before the servants of David. And there were 3 sons of Zeruiah there, Joab, and Abishai, and Asahel. And Asahel was as light of foot as a wild roe. And Asahel pursued after Abner, and in going he turned not to the right hand nor to the left from following Abner. Then Abner looked behind him and said, art thou Asahel? And he answered, I am. And Abner said to him, turn thee aside to the right hand or to the left, and lay thee hold on one of the young men, and take thee his armor. But Asahel would not turn from following him. And Abner said to Asahel, turn thee aside from following me. Wherefore should I smite thee to the ground? How then should I hold up my head to Joab thy brother? Howbeit he refused to turn aside, wherefore Abner with the hinder end of the spear smote him under the 5th rib, that the spear came out behind him, and he fell down there and died in the same place. And it came to pass, as many as came to the place where Asahel fell down and died stood still. Joab also and Abishai pursued after Abner, and the sun went down when they were come to the hill of Ammah that lieth before Gaia by the way of the wilderness of Gibeon. And the children of Benjamin gathered themselves together after Abner and became one troop and stood on the top of an hill. Then Abner called to Joab and said, shall the sword devour forever? Knowest thou not that it will be bitterness in the latter end? How long shall it be ere thou bid the people from following their brethren? And Joab said, as God liveth, unless thou hadst spoken, surely then in the morning the people had gone up every one from following his brother. So Joab blew a trumpet, and all the people stood still and pursued after Israel no more, neither fought they any more. And Abner and his men walked all that night through the plain and passed over Jordan and went through all Bithron and came to Mahanaim. And Joab returned from following Abner, and when he had gathered all the people together, there lacked of David's servants 19 men and Asahel. But the servants of David had smitten of Benjamin and Abner's men, so that 300 and 80 men died. And they took up Asahel and buried him in the sepulchre of his father, which was in Bethlehem. And Joab and his men went all night, and they came to Hebron at the break of day. Let's pray. Father, I ask that you would open up this word to our hearts, and do help us to love everything that you say and to do our best to apply all of it to our lives. Amen. We saw this morning in chapter 1 that it was absolutely not in David's heart that Saul died, in spite of the fact that Saul had been pursuing him forever. Saul was killed in the battle with his sons, and David lamented it. In fact, David killed one of the Amalekites who killed Saul. And we come to the next phase now of David's life. Now the reason David had been out of the country of Israel was because Saul was trying to kill him. And so now David has no reason to be gone from Israel anymore. And so it says in verse 1, "It came to pass after this that David inquired of the Lord, saying, Shall I go up into any of the cities of Judah? And the Lord said unto him, Go up. And David said, Whither shall I go up? And he said unto Hebron. So David went up thither. He goes with his wives. He goes with all his men and all their households. And they come to Hebron and they dwell there. And it says in verse 4, "The men of Judah came, and there they anointed David king over the house of Judah." Now, David had already been anointed king by Samuel, under the direct command of God for Samuel to go anoint him king, some years previous to this. I don't think we know exactly how long ago it was, but some years previous to this, David had been anointed king. David could not be the king of Israel because Saul was. And David knew that he had no business to change the situation that was, and so he was waiting patiently for God's time. Now he comes back to Israel after being gone for all this time, Saul being dead. He comes back to Israel, but he does not come back to Israel to take the kingdom. He does not come back and go straight to Saul's place and say, "Hey, here I am now. I have Saul's crown. I was anointed by Samuel, the prophet you guys all loved. I'm the king now." He doesn't do that. He does not. There was, up until this point in David's life, there was nothing that he did to take the kingdom over Israel. But once he becomes the king over Judah by the request of the people, a new phase opens up in David's life where it says there was long war between the house of David and the house of Saul. A few years it went on that there was fighting in the nation of Israel between the people of God and the people of God, fighting each other, because after Saul died, the head of the army, Abner, went and made Saul's son the king. And David was not made the king over Israel. He was only anointed to be the king over Judah. I do not understand. We don't have the full story of everything that happened here. And according to everything that we have seen in David's life up until this time, I do not think that David would have done anything at all to take the kingdom over the rest of the nation of Israel if they had not come and pressured him into war. That's my personal opinion. That's how I view David. I don't think he would have done anything. But Abner sets up Saul's son to be the king, and then Abner gathers together an army of people to go have a war. Let's see who's really going to be the king, Saul's son or David. And when this happens, as we read in this chapter, when this happens, Joab then gathers David's men together. And they meet in a certain place where there's a pool. And Abner sits down on one side of the pool with his men, and Joab sits down on the other side of the pool with his men. It doesn't look like a war. It doesn't look like there should be a fight here. It looks like, honestly, they sat down to play a game, but put men's lives at stake. Abner sinned. Abner was not anointed by God to be the prophet. He was not anointed by God to be the king. He was not given any authority at all to take any part in the decision in the nation of Israel as to who was going to be the king. And the law said that if they ever made a king over them, that they were to choose whom God said to be the king. Now, as we read in the case of Saul, Saul was chosen to be the king. Then before Saul ever died, David was chosen to be the king. To David, promises were given that it would be his son that would sit on the throne forever. So after David has become the king and the promises have been made to David that his sons would reign over Israel, from there on, I don't honestly know exactly how much God expected of the nation of Israel to look to him for guidance. I don't think they ever did. Except for the specific instance of David's son Solomon, when David had many sons and God told him it was going to be Solomon that sat on the throne, there is not one single instance in all the rest of the books of the Kings where they sought God's advice on which son of the king was to be the king. I imagine that was God's plan and that was God's interest, but they didn't do it. But it was, at least, they did know that it was to be one of the sons of David who was to reign in the stead of the king who died. They had no information at all about Saul. The only thing they knew for certain about Saul was that he had been rejected and David had been anointed. So Abner, as the head of the head of the army of Saul, goes out and anoints somebody to be the king who God had not chosen, who God had not said anything about, and now it doesn't matter anymore. It doesn't matter anymore if Abner was right or wrong in what he did. Ishbosheth is the king of Israel. He has been made the king of Israel, whether it was right or whether it was wrong. And there is a million things that we face every day in our lives because somebody did something wrong. And it puts pressure on us. It puts us in situations we shouldn't be in. It puts hard choices in our lives because we face situations that aren't right. And we oftentimes, we don't know exactly how to handle those situations. But ultimately, the first thing that we want to do is make sure that we don't create those situations. There was no reason under the sun for Abner to put anything in. He had no business at all putting his finger in this situation. It was not his business. He was the head of the army. He's an interesting character. He wanted to have a war with the servants of David over who was going to be the king, apparently. But yet, during the war, he's being pursued by Asahel, one of Joab's brothers, and he doesn't want to kill him, because he doesn't know how he will hold up his head to Joab. Why is he concerned about holding up his head to Joab if he is going and anointing one of Saul's sons to be the king against David and against David's men and against David's army? Why does he care? What's more, in just a short while, when Abner is he maintains his friendship with the king that he puts in place, but the king happens to say one little thing to Abner about a certain woman that the king accuses Abner of having done something to. And Abner says, am I a dog's head that you accuse me with a fault concerning this woman? And he says, you know what? And I'm not quoting now. He says, I'm going to do what the Lord said to David. As the Lord has sworn that David was going to be king over all Israel, so I am going to bring the kingdom to him. He says this to the king that he anointed or that he made to be the king over Israel. I get the idea from all the different things that we do know about Abner was that he was not a very good man. He was probably the kind of person you wouldn't want to be friends with. Can you imagine? Look at the difference between how David was insulted by Saul for many years and just took it. And Abner gets one question from the king and he immediately turns his back on him and says, I'm giving the kingdom to David. Abner never got to take part in David's kingdom because Joab, who was also not a good man, never forgave him for the fact that he killed his brother. And so when David accepts Abner's apologies and accepts him as his friend, Joab goes and kills him, and he dies. He was probably worthy of that, though it was none of Joab's business to do it. And Joab also was eventually put to death by David's son, Solomon, because of all the evil things that he did in his life. So we're not looking to these men who are the heads of these armies for advice on how to be right with God. But the question that I would have in this situation is, where's David? Why isn't David? Every time you read in the stories, every war that you read about, just about David's at, he's taking part in it. And he's not here. Why did David send his army to have this fight that we read about in this chapter? Was David in agreement that something needed to be done? I don't believe that let's remember the fact that David had sworn to Saul that he would not hurt Saul's seed. He wouldn't do anything against Saul's sons. He had promised that to Saul. Saul had asked him, when you become king, please don't hurt my children. And David had promised. I don't believe that it was in David's heart to kill Saul's son. I don't think that David would have done anything to fight for his rights. But somehow we end up with a battle here, pushed by two wicked men, Abner and Joab. The only problem is, Abner and Joab don't die in the battle, and about 400 other men do. And these aren't the nations that God had told Israel to destroy. These are the children of Israel. These are the people of the promise, the people who are supposed to be the servants of God, building up the nation. The first thing that happens when they get together, Abner decides, he says to Joab, let the young men now arise and play before us. And Joab should have said, no, what are we going to fight over? That's what he should have said. But he said, let them arise. And so 12 people out of each one of the armies meet together. And it seems, from everything that I can read, that nobody can understand what exactly takes place when those 12 people meet. Half the people believe that all 24 of them die immediately as they kill each other. And the other half believe that it was David's men who kill all of Abner's men immediately. It's kind of ambiguous the way it says it. It says, then there arose and went over by number 12 of Benjamin, which pertained to Ishbosheth, the son of Saul, and 12 of the servants of David. And they caught every one his fellow by the head, and thrust his sword in his fellow's side, so they fell down together. And it leaves it open when it says they caught everyone, his fellow, by the head. Was that they referring immediately back to the 12 servants of David that just preceded, or was it referring back to the 12 servants of Ishbosheth and the 12 servants of David when it uses the word they? And so there's a little bit of fighting going on about if it was just Abner's men who died at that moment, or if it was all 24 of them. Yes. It comes at the end of this chapter, and it's 19. It says in verse 30, there lacked of David's servants 19 men and Asahel. But the servants of David had smitten of Benjamin and of Abner's men, so that 300 men died. So somewhere in the course of the day in the battle, 19 people from David's army died. That would have been 12 from the original fight and 5 additional, or it could have been simply 19 other people from throughout the day. It doesn't really make a huge difference how, to us, how it went. I don't think we really need to understand that point. But whatever happened at that moment, a battle ensued that took them the rest of the day till the sun went down. And Joab's brother, Asahel, he had the right idea. From a warrior's perspective, I think he had the right idea. This Abner here is the problem. He is the one who went and anointed somebody without the people's permission and without God's permission to be the king. Now he's asking for war. We need to get this guy. And so he says, I am going after him. I'm putting my life in my hands. I'm going after him. And he goes. And Abner twice turns to him while he's chasing him and says, don't do it. I don't know how I will hold up my head to your brother if I have to kill you. But he doesn't listen. And so he dies. You know, lots of people make choices. It feels almost like you're playing a game. You make a choice. This is how I'm going to do this. Or you're running a business. You make a choice. This is how I'm going to do this. And once you've set yourself on the course, it's very difficult to change. This is going to succeed or it's not. But the course is set. That's sort of what it looks like here. I am giving it everything that I have. I'm going to get Abner. But he failed. He failed and he lost his life. It's too bad. It's really too bad that there wasn't some level-headed people sitting in that kingdom on both sides that could have sat down and discussed these issues and decided that it wasn't worth having a war over. Unfortunately, people don't tend to come level-headed. I've seen a lot more people with a lot of bad ideas than I've ever met with good ideas. So, the war goes on. And now, this is only the beginning. We don't even have the record of everything that happened. It says in the first verse of chapter 3, now there was long war between the house of Saul and the house of David. But David waxed stronger and stronger, and the house of Saul waxed weaker and weaker. David, of course, you know, if you've read this all, David never did kill Ishbosheth. What happened, Abner ends up dying after he gets in a fight with Ishbosheth, and he decides to join David in his kingdom. And Joab kills Abner, and at this point, Ishbosheth feels very weak, and some wicked people come into his house in the middle of the day when he's laying down on his bed and kill him. And they come to David with his head. "We killed Ishbosheth for you." And David immediately kills those men as murderers for killing, as he says it, a righteous man on his own bed. No matter what we think about Ishbosheth, he didn't do anything wrong to David. He may not have been right to be the king, as God had not set him there, but he didn't do anything wrong to David. And those who killed him were recognized by David as murderers, who he didn't allow to live. Well, after Abner is beaten in the battle, he loses 360 men. He then stands up to Joab and says, "Shall the sword devour forever? Knowest thou not that it will be bitterness in the latter end? How long shall it be then ere thou bid the people from following their brethren?" That was a good thing for him to stand up and say. It's too bad he didn't say it before it started. You will find, as you read church history, that throughout the history of the church, things that were wrong happen over and over and over again. People were wrong. Things start wrong. Churches fight. Christians fight. The fathers of this country left European nations to come to a place where they had freedom to worship God. And they immediately set up a country that did not allow freedom to worship God for anybody but themselves. And fights began to ensue in the early history of our country, where people were imprisoned and put to death for differing religious beliefs than the people who came over first. It wasn't until many years later that the idea of religious liberty that we still experience today was developed in this country, where people were free to have differing opinions and not kill each other over it. That was a good thing. That was a good thing this country did. Why? Why, when we look back at history, it was the good people who did these wrong things over and over and over again. It was the good people. It was John Calvin who burned people at the stake who differed from him on opinions about the Bible. It wasn't just the Catholics who did that. It was the Reformers too. So many people did so many things in history that were so wrong. And we can't even look back and sort all of it out. We can't even understand. It's very clear. We know, when we look back at John Calvin, we know from everything about the Christian dispensation, he had no business putting anybody to death for differing religious beliefs. We know that. But we can't look back and sort everything out. Some things are foggy. We have this problem in our country. Well, sorry, not our country. We have this problem in the world where the church is divided into denominations. We don't know what to deal with that. The Plymouth Brethren did. They knew exactly what to do to deal with this denominational problem. They said we should not have denominations because the church is one church. And so they went to form a denomination because they wouldn't be a part of any of the denominations. And they still vehemently deny to this day that they are a denomination, but they are. How do you solve that problem? This church is independent. We aren't part of any denomination, but we're too small to be a denomination. If we get hundreds of people together under the same fellowship in multiple cities, we'll be a denomination by that point. The independent Baptists have a different way they handle things. They believe that they have to be Baptist to be right with God, but they should not be a part of a denomination. So they're independent Baptists, and they are a denomination. Now, the fact of the matter is, if you are here tonight and you are saved, you are a part of the Church of God. You didn't make yourself a part of the Church of God. God made you a part of the Church of God when He accepted you as one of His sons and His daughters. He made you a part of His church, and He has one church. And in fact, He has saved people in all the different denominations where they preach the gospel. And they're all one church. And when He takes His church up to heaven, they're going to come sailing from all sorts of places, from all denominations, from all churches, from all countries. They're all going to come sailing up to God to one location, and they are going to be one church. Now, how many of you guys think you can go fix this problem tomorrow? Don't even try. First, number one, let's recognize the truth of one body. Okay, let's recognize that truth. But second, let's not try to impose that on anybody's head. You ain't going to get anywhere. We could go on and on and on about lists of things that have been done wrong in history. Things that have been done wrong that we can't go fix. And the best thing that we can do is do our very best to be right with God on all points of scriptural practice and to be very unjudgmental on people who have differing backgrounds. We have to be somewhat judgmental. And the Bible does say, there's a balance now, the Bible does say, he that is spiritual judges all things. And we are never going to say, well, the ecumenical movement is right. Every way leads to Jesus. You can be a Hindu, you can be a Catholic, you can be a Jehovah's Witness, you can be, all ways lead to Jesus. No, they don't. No, only the Bible way of salvation through faith in Jesus Christ leads to God. That's it. And anybody who believes any other thing, anybody who teaches any other thing, is not saved. Their church is not right with God. It is not a church, and we know those things. But we're not talking about things that are directly opposed to the basics of the Bible. We're talking about little far-out doctrines that literally have almost no impact in a person's life. I read many years ago, I read Charles Chinnicky's book, 50 Years in the Church of Rome. It's a great book. And he says in that book, the Catholic Church is always the same and it will never change. He said they will always be this. And I kind of viewed the Catholic Church of today as a little bit more lenient and less horrible in their doctrines. I just heard a story last night. It came through one of my employees. The Catholic Church hasn't changed. The story goes like this. You have to go to confession. When you're at confession, all the sins that you confess gets written down on a piece of paper. And the priest takes that piece of paper and he writes a dollar amount by each one. And if you want those sins forgiven, you pay the priest that much. Now that priest is going to hell. And anybody who goes and confesses to that priest is going to hell because only Jesus can save them. We know that. But that's quite a different wrong doctrine than somebody who thinks that they should stay a part of the Church of England. John Wesley actually taught quite strongly against some of the things of the Church of England. He just believed it was the church. So he said, if it's the church, we have to be members of it. Well, it wasn't the church, but he didn't understand that. And John Wesley and George Whitefield, who were best of friends throughout their lives, developed different doctrines on salvation, where George Whitefield held very strongly to a Calvinistic idea, and John Wesley held very strongly to an Arminian idea. Their followers have fought much, but John Wesley and George Whitefield didn't fight over it. If Calvinism and Arminianism are two somewhat opposing doctrines of God, the one thing that is still true is that in spite of those opposing doctrines, about 99.9% of everything that those two doctrines believe about the gospel of Jesus Christ is identical. I need to go, I should go change every Calvinist mind about their false doctrines. No, actually, wrong. Because it can't be done. They actually have a much stronger feeling about changing the Arminians' minds than the Arminians have about them. It always happens that way. The people who are right have a more lenient feeling towards the people who are wrong. The people who are wrong have a much stronger feeling towards the people who are right. It always happens that way. Calvinists can become very, very bigoted. Some of them, not all. I know some very unbigoted Calvinists as well. I don't know any bigoted Arminians, though. I'm glad for that. I'm not one. There is some. What was David's place in this chapter? It may be that David was forced as the king of Judah to defend his people against Abner in a situation that he would have never chosen to be in. He maybe didn't have the option to get out of this. Maybe it was, maybe if he hadn't done this, the army of Abner would have come and hurt his people. And then as the king, he had the responsibility to stand up and defend them. I don't know exactly what happened here, but it's a mess. It is an absolute mess. It never should have happened. It only happened because people did wrong things. Those messes continue to exist today. And we want to get through them as best as we can without creating any more to the mess, without making anything any worse wrong, keeping a walk with God and a clear mind, and not allowing the things that we see in other people to affect us. But yet, at the same time, we want to know where the limits are, and we want to know when it is time to stand up and make trouble. Because sometimes we have to. So, I think with that, we will finish that chapter and dismiss.